David, nice having you on the podcast. Thank you for making time to be with us today.
It is my pleasure. How's it going?
We're great, man. We're great. What were some of the shows that you were watching when you were growing up that made you go, this could be a job?
That's an interesting question. SCTV was one that just came to mind. Second City Television. I loved watching Saturday Night Live, and I loved shows like Taxi and later Cheers. And I know I'm forgetting some of the bigger ones, but what I really loved watching as a kid was VHS tapes or beta tapes of Woody Allen movies and Steve Martin specials from NBC. Those were the ones that really formed me a lot, and watching just like certain movies over and over and over again, like Heaven Can Wait, and just ingesting certain rhythms that made me feel over time just comfortable because they were so ingrained in me.
You know, whenever I speak to an American, I realize how rich your culture is steeped in television. You guys had Gilligan's Island, you had the Hornet, you had all of these shows that you guys were, Starsky and Hutch. You can go back decades and find TV shows that your parents enjoyed, your older brother enjoyed, that you enjoyed, and to a point where as a man now you are writing TV shows that another generation enjoys, right?
Well, it's so interesting how much we want to watch shows from the past, from before we were even born. I know I watched all the time, every day on syndication, those shows you just mentioned, Dick Van Dyke Show, I Love Lucy, you know, from the 50s, me growing up in the 70s and 80s. And now my own children love watching like The Office over and over again. It's just sort of, maybe it connects you to the recent past in some strange way. I don't know.
I always think of it as humans, we crave the interaction. The voyeurism that sitcoms offers us is incredible. It almost feels like the characters are just standing there waiting for you to show up for them to start.
If you're watching TV in South Africa, how much of it is American and how much of it is not?
Most of it is American. I think we only started changing now a little bit with more content being on paid channels. But most of it, what we grew up watching was, I remember in the township, I was maybe 14, and me and my friends were always looking forward to Mondays because we would talk about what episode of Seinfeld was on, or Murphy Brown, you know, if we were lucky to stick around that long at night.
It's so strange to me, you know, you get so myopic here because all those shows are made down the street from where I am right now. And
that's incredible.
And think of them, and then to know that people grow up and is it just strange to watch a whole imported culture as your main thing? But I guess that's just how it was set up for so long, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And you must remember that in the township where English is not your first language, to have a group of friends, four of us, who just loved interrogating the gags that we heard and the scenario that we saw and what made people laugh. And it would be adults, right? And it would be male white adults predominantly that would watch sitcoms like that. And here we were in the township and we found that humor interesting. So we were unique in our way. So we started watching a lot of those shows and we recorded with VHS. And then when we leave school early on a Friday, we would go and play the tapes and we would just watch them over and over and over. So you can imagine what a mind fuck it was. Sorry?
I said, how cool that is.
Yeah. So you can imagine what a mind fuck it was years later to watch Jerry Seinfeld perform live. Then you go, me and my friends used to talk about the episode of Seinfeld that this happened and that happened and this happened and that happened. Now he is performing. And, you know, it just shows you that anything is possible and the world is so small.
But I thought on Seinfeld, nothing happens.
One of few things is guaranteed to happen. A door is going to open. A fridge is going to be opened.
Right.
You know, he's going to be frustrated about something and then something is not going to happen at the end.
And he'll have some cereal.
So out of all your shows, right? Do you look at them as your kids and you go, which project was your favorite? Which project is filled with great memories?
I mean, I really do. It's just my mindset. I really do love just about all of it. And I actually make an effort not to get too nostalgic just because I could get I could look backwards too much, and I don't want to do that. But I definitely, I work on these things until I feel like I'm really in love with them, I guess. And then and so most of the movies and TV shows that I've done, I really do I like the I associate the result about equally with just the whole experience of making it in my own mind. And so it's a different perception than somebody on the outside might have. But so I mean, each one has a different thing. Like making the first movie, Wet Hot American Summer, has its own very special place in my heart because it was the first time to do so many things, and the shoot was a really special experience of bonding with people and being stuck in the middle of nowhere and pouring rain all the time, and I was younger. And but I absolutely love, for example, the thing I did last year, Medical Police, which is a Netflix show where we got to go shoot a quarter of it in Croatia, and we did like a giant action series for 2 cents, and it was I loved how it came out. And and I love what I'm working on right now, and I just it's I feel very, very, very lucky to have had the chance to, over the many years, work with my friends and explore comedic ideas, and been given the support to have them get made. Not so much during the last months of quarantine, but up until then.
When you look at Wet Hot American Summer and you look at Medical Police, do you feel a vibe when you're writing something that's going to be such a phenomenon?
No, I mean certainly not in those days with when we were shooting Wet Hot American Summer, it was a low budget indie movie, and our hope was that it would come out in any way. Like we did not think it would get a theatrical release. We didn't we just didn't we were just thinking, wow, we thought it was really going well enough to think like, wow, that no matter what, somebody's going to see this. Our big goal was that it gets released at least in one theater so that the New York Times would review it.
That's all you guys wanted. That's all
That's
you
all
were
we wanted.
shooting for.
And as it turned out, it only did get released in like two theaters at first, and then a smattering afterwards, and then it never made money in the theaters. But then it just grew years later, really. It didn't make a profit for 7 years until after it came out. And then it was just over the decades that it really grew and grew and grew to become this like legendary movie in many people's minds, which is very ne never could have been expected and incredibly gratifying.
Yeah. And then when you think about then and now, the new project that you have now on Netflix, did you ever anticipate it being so big?
Well, I mean, now I have sort of the opposite sensation. Like when we were shooting the Netflix show, for example, I was like, this is so great. I'm super psyched and loving it. And then it came out on Netflix and it got incredible reviews, and people were like, this is great. And then it basically petered out and no one really watched it. And so I have opposite experiences sometimes. I mean, most of the things I've done, almost all of the things I've done, have been commercial, financial, small to medium at best. But they enjoy a vocal and loyal following of a small number, and I prefer I'll choose that any day of the week.
I read somewhere that humans have 60,000 thoughts a day. How do you as a writer select one thought to turn into a movie or into a series? How do you sift through all your thoughts and go, this is something?
I do feel like part of the main challenge of the job, or the task of the job, is doing exactly that. It's taking away your judgment or your inhibitions and just saying like, okay, I'm gonna take this and run with it. But if you're asking like, how do I balance out the different things that I might want to try to do, or where do I put my time and energy and attention? That's an ongoing challenge for me, and always has been. Where do you put your emphasis? Where do you put your because everything's rolling the dice in this business, you know. And I'm not, I would love to be at the level where I just say, I'm going to do this next, and then I know it'll happen, you know. But it's more that I have to keep a bunch of plates spinning and see which ones land, and I, or don't land, I guess, in the metaphor of plate spinning. I don't like that. I'm looking literally at my on my board right now. I have like 15 things that I'm working on right now, and I wish it was one thing. And I'm happiest when I'm, I do, I am. Well, I'm happiest when I'm immersed entirely in one project, because one project alone is 40 different topics. Like if I'm working on Medical Police, I'm thinking about casting and the scripts and the locations and the editing and the, you know, there's so many different aspects to making something. So I like that versus trying to think about 20 different projects. I mean, that has its, it has its rewards too. Sometimes you shift gears and one sheds light on another. But overall, I would rather be more monofocused. I always think about Paul Rudd, the actor who I've worked with a lot, who really has a brain, from my observation, that he focuses on one thing at a time and that's it. And I think that that is admirable. And I mean, he can do that, but I, it's a goal of mine to be able to think more in the, in those terms. And it drives people crazy who are trying to talk to him about the next thing. But he really gets his mind into the thing that he's doing right now, and that's it.
So you aspire to be single-minded.
Yeah, I think monotasking is the new thing.
But I think it's not for everyone. I think there's certain types of people whose brains will never function like that, right? Because I
Yeah, and
think
probably in reality, mine is, I'm one of those.
yes,
But
because I think to be a stand-up comedian, first of all, you'd know this better than anyone, that your brain works in a different way. You know, you've selected the gear that you're going into next while you're in this gear right now. So if you were to focus on one thing, so many things would just get you off of your game. So I guess
Exactly.
it's a gift and a curse.
Yeah, I'm not a stand-up, but I really do admire stand-up so much for that and other reasons. And I've always thought that at some point when I have the balls to do it, I'm going to try it. And like, but I feel like if I did, I mean, I've done like things like stand-up or adjacent to stand-up my whole life, but I feel like when I try stand-up, I want to devote like a year, 7 nights a week to doing it, to like to see if I can get that muscle in a real way, you know.
How long before you start going on that journey? Because I think that would be interesting.
Probably when my kids go to college would be the time.
How many years is that?
It'll be about 8 years from now.
Do your kids think you have a real job? Do they look at you and go, Dad,
They're like,
aren't you gonna
Dad,
go do
you,
work like other dads?
my, yeah, exactly. My kids think I am literally the unfunniest person on earth, and also just like the biggest dork. And so, in fact, we were playing this game with other kids on Zoom, like other family, and it was about everyone has to make different jokes, and then you judge back and forth. And I came in dead last. So I'm like, this is not bode well for me putting food on the table.
Your kids know what you do for a living?
Yeah, they know. And they've seen and liked certain things, and then other things they've expressed, like I've said, you should watch like Wet Hot American Summer, and they're like, nah. But they did love Medical Police, and they loved Stella, our show that we did year, I guess 15 years ago on Comedy Central.
Are they your biggest critics? Do you watch from behind the couch whenever they're watching something you've made and go, I hope they laugh? Like the creeps that walk into theaters and look at the fans reacting to a Star Wars movie.
Well, we've watched certain things together. I mean, my kids are like, Dad, you're a dork and a loser. And then I hear them bragging about me to their friends, so I know that they're putting on a face.
I've always struggled with this, David. This is just me now. Personal, selfish question. Whenever I am writing something. When do you know when you've hit a dead end? You know, with a joke, you know, because the audience lets you know, right? So whenever you're doing stand-up, you know when the audience hits that ultimate laugh and you know you cannot go any further with the laughs, you know, then you switch topics. With writing, I always find that I just end up keep going and going and going and going, and I never know when to stop because I never feel like it's finished.
I think that you need those things that are the equivalent of the audience, which is could be have someone else read it, or you just, for me, a lot of times it's just hearing it read aloud in any form is often so illuminating. And so if I'm writing something, you know, I often write with a partner, but we'll read it aloud, or we'll get someone to read aloud, and nobody has to say anything or give us a note. You just by hearing it, you're like, oh my God, cut out those 10 pages, or that's not working, or this whole aspect of it, or this whole through line is going nowhere. Let's dump it, you know? But seeing writing through another lens of some sort is crucial. You can't just sit there. I can't just sit there and stare at something and then hope to move past whatever challenges in there.
Mm. You just read it through and work it out.
Yeah. Read it through, hear it read through. Sometimes it's just changing the context of it, literally, like, you know, printing it out instead of seeing it on the screen and then looking at it as a piece of paper sometimes helps me see it in a different, more objective light.
How much of the writing process is, one, nostalgia, and two, fantasy? Where do those two meet?
Can you elaborate or explain that question? I don't understand.
When sometimes when you're writing a movie, right? Say, for example, you're writing Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah.
You are most likely to go into your past and remember something that happened.
Sure.
A character that you know. Or, yeah.
Okay. Well, certainly in that movie, it was a lot of nostalgia. More than you might think. Michael Showalter and I went through our own summer camp experiences and just sort of really charted out every memory and impression we had. And a lot of the stories in that were, at least as a starting point, taken from that. And then we added our jokes and our imagination to it. And just depending on what it is, certainly Medical Police, on the other hand, is about experiences that none of us who wrote it had ever had at all. You know, it's about doctors who are secret agents traveling the world and trying to stop a virus, a worldwide pandemic. And so that was more just fantasy and playing in a genre. Mm. But I guess it just depends on what it is. I've written other things that are much more personal in their source, and I've written other things that are much more whimsical in their source, and everything has different starting place or seed that I try to stick to as you go along. I keep going back. Whenever I'm working on many things right now, where I keep saying to myself, what's the spine? What's the rudder? Why did I start this? You know, and then we keep going back to it.
And the answer, whatever you get there.
Yeah. And sometimes, it's, you know, and there are many, obviously there's been hundreds of projects that ended up just not happening, you know, or going nowhere. But one of the things I learned early on is, and I'm sure you know this is a stand-up, you got to just give things a chance, and you have to know that it's not going to be perfect to start, and you got to have some faith in, like, any idea can be worked on and bent into shape, and it may not be a masterpiece at the end, but you can make it into something. So, and that quantity is just as important as quality. And you know, if you write 100 jokes, you're more likely to write 10 good jokes than if you write 12 jokes.
I think the quality part, as you get older, most certainly for me, it's you become more selfish, and you want every process that you embark on to be helpful and useful to you, right? Right.
Well, so I think, yeah.
So people always use the word, no, I want to be able to be proud of my work. And that's just another metaphor for it. How did this help you get through whatever you were going through?
Yeah. And I do feel, you know, as I got older and had children and the world is the world. I just find that my entire work life has to now be put into a certain, like, the use of my time becomes a very more pronounced priority. And like, I want to make sure that I'm not wasting too much time just wandering through my brain.
Apparently, when what apparently, if you don't have money, you give out your time for money, and then if you have money, you give out time for your money.
Exactly. And that's,
Right?
but acknowledging that is important, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and I, and we all do that. Like, you know, if you're, if you have tons and tons of money, spending most of your day clipping coupons or looking for discounts at the supermarket is probably not your best way to spend your time. Something like that.
I always think, how does wanting, desperately wanting to earn money, enough money to almost as if feel like you're buying your freedom, right? Because that's what a lot of money does for you. It just liberates you. It allows you to be in places that you want to be in at the time
Yeah.
that you want to be in. And even people take something for granted, like waking up at a certain time. With the luxury of
Totally.
having money, something that simple becomes your choice, right? And
Well, yeah. I mean, just that I still every day I thank God that I don't have to do something other than what I do, you know, to make a living. And so far I've been able to eke it out by doing something in the arts like this instead of going to do a real job. And I can't believe it. I still can't believe it. And I don't take it for granted.
at all.
I don't think so. I mean, it's like, I know that, and I've worked in, when I was younger, I worked in various jobs and I, you know, I just, you know, I know that it's what it's like to wake up and go to work and not want to do it. And
Yeah.
I never have that. I mean, I almost, even when I'm working on a project that's not my favorite, or if I'm doing a part of the project that's not my favorite part, I still basically enjoy what I do to some degree every day. And that's a great gift.
How much of having not to worry about finances contributes to the kind of product that you put out as a
Well,
human being, just in general?
I do worry a lot about finances.
You
I
made Josh's day.
ironically,
Josh is like, you and I are on the same boat. Finally, Josh is like, yes.
I mean, it's very strange because, but probably by almost any standard, I make, I guess you would say, a lot of money, but I really struggle to make ends meet every month and every year because I live in LA, which is so expensive, and I have two kids and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, and I do actually live a quite a modest lifestyle, relatively speaking. But so a lot of my, if I really didn't have to worry about money, to answer your question, I would do things slightly differently. But on the other hand, I have always made my choices in my career based on what is meaningful to me, not on money. Otherwise, I probably would be rich at this point, or might have had a chance to be rich. But instead, I've always chosen to do the smaller, weirder project and often lost money on it or didn't make money on it. And but I feel the richer for it because as I said, I've bought myself that ability to go into work every day and do something I enjoy. There's so many people who work in this industry, and I see them all the time in LA, who spend all day long for years and years working on something they don't care about. And there's so many shows and movies that are made that you can tell nobody who's involved with it cares about it, you know.
Really?
Sure, I mean, there's just all these random TV shows on the air, and you can tell they're just put out there because they're put out there, and there's no brain or soul behind it where someone's saying, "I want to make this show. It matters to me. It means something to me." And then there are shows in every genre where people do love it and do get it behind it. But anyway, that's all I got to say about that. That's my way of abandoning a thought halfway through and then just bailing.
That was a conversation version of closing down your laptop.
Yep.
What's your dream project, Dave? What is the one thing that you still want to make?
I'm dying to make. I mean, I've stepped closer to it. The last movie I made was called A Futile and Stupid Gesture. It was a biopic about Doug Kenny, who was the founder of the National Lampoon. It's on Netflix. It's great. Check it out. But I want to do something that's still comedic, but like as a deeper, more serious, more personal feature film. That's kind of my dream. Because I love, the trend more and more is people are doing more things, social media, and shorter and quicker and more immediate, which is great. And I've done that kind of thing also my entire life. I did web series and stuff, but I like the idea of, I really enjoy when I get to take time to craft something over a years. And what I love about doing a comedic feature film is you write a joke and it and the joke lasts all the way through all the process of writing and rehearsing and shooting and through the editing and changing and then mixing all the way through. And if you're still laughing at it, it's stood the test of time. And I'd like to just go deeper into that process.
You know what I've just realized? Maybe it's because of the algorithm on my streaming services, but now I see more and more of World War II stuff. And I look at it and I go, how many people has this topic employed? Like you look at it's basically from history reenactments to depictions, you're like, this the concept of Nazis has just over the years since television has
The
employed
fascination has never gone away. It's true. It's interesting.
it has never gone, and they find these actors that match almost to the T how those people in that time looked in their uniform, and I go, how crazy is this that someone at some point, and I guess because I'm a big fan of past life regression and Dr. Wise, who pioneered the industry of past life regression, who regressed a lot of people that have lived past lives and they remember certain things so vividly and so well. And I always think to myself, how much, if that theory is to be believed, right? How much of those people involved in that kind of film or documentaries or reenactments remember vividly somewhere in a distant past, even if they don't know how, that they used to be in that they can play that part or direct that scene so well that I'm sitting all the way in South Africa and going, I feel like I'm in Berlin.
It does make sense to me. I mean, I'm sure there are actors who make their entire life career as playing various types of Nazis in different things because they look the part. Or there are, yeah, I think that's pretty interesting.
That is crazy. I look at it and I go, where does the funding come from for pushing this agenda? Because I think, wait, is it funded by people who go never forget, or is it funded by people that are pro-Nazi? Because somehow isn't having that much content about that painful era making people remember more, and some people who are still alive now relive it.
Yes, I think there's always that double-edged sword, but I think it's the fascination with the extreme of that time is what it is. People say like, what was the craziest? Who's the most evil man who ever lived? Adolf Hitler, or whatever. And like, I want to know more. And what they pulled off, just like everything that's tragic, whether it's the fascination of the spectacle of the sinking of the Titanic or the spectacle of 9/11. People look at the spectacle of the Final Solution, and inevitably there are those who then start to admire it, and then there are those who start to ape it. It does happen. And I know I remember in high school there were always those kids who were just like obsessed with Nazis, and they would, research and read all the books, and they would start to get, the draw the insignias and stuff. And it's not that they were even. They weren't neo-Nazis. They weren't trying to, but they were definitely obsessed, you know. And I just think about, you know, there's probably companies that make their entire income from creating Nazi uniforms for film and TV. You know, it's just crazy.
But that's what I'm trying to say. And I haven't discussed this with anybody. And
is you it just me? Wait, let's hold off on this till David Wayne gets here. Then we're going to get into the Nazi stuff.
It was on my mind, and I thought to myself, isn't this ironic that an industry is now supported by the most painful part of world history? It's a huge business. It's a huge commercial business. Like, you're right. If there's a factory out there making these uniforms and these Schwarzenegger medals, and they go, no, it's not real. It's for this thing that we're shooting that makes it look real. Isn't the factory functioning the same as the factory that created the uniform? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I do, but you know, the other alternative is you don't do it. Like, you know, you have to. Forgetting would be worse, probably. You know, not being. You know, growing up Jewish and I remember how important it always was to document the Holocaust and teach it to our children, to make sure that, because as soon as you forget, then that's really when it can happen again, is what we were told. So I still see that. And you know, I was part of a lot of projects when I was younger, interviewing and documenting survivors so that,
really?
Before they died, basically. Yeah. So many.
Yeah.
And that was an ongoing, you know, Spielberg was involved in that sort of thing, just so that you have these firsthand accounts so that you, because, you know, as you know, we live in a time now of very flexible truth, and people, and a lot, there are a lot of deniers who say, no, that never happened. It's an all exaggeration. So now, you know, there's these hours and hours and hours and hours of tapes that me and others made where you say, okay, tell us exactly what you went through, blow by blow. And then at least we have that.
You know what I would love, David? I would love for there to be a documentary that tells us who are the people that shot most of those videos that exposed these atrocities that even now we're using them as references, right? Like who, even if it was, because I once saw a film where it spoke of the people in the camp who were secretly getting the film out of pictures that were taken, right? But I'm like, even the Nazi soldiers that were there, that were videotaping and documenting, I would love to find out the story behind the camera.
Yeah, well, I know that the Nazis were very into filming their own stuff all the time. That's what they were massive documenters of their own activities. And I think that's a lot of why we know as much as we do. I can't speak with any more. If I said one more sentence, I would be making things up, but that's what I know.
I've watched a great show called Hunter. Have you watched it on Amazon? Mm-hmm. Oh, you must watch it.
Hunter.
It stars Al Pacino.
Okay.
He's in it. He plays a Jewish man who was in the Holocaust in the 70s now, 30 odd years later. And he's wealthy, lives in Manhattan, and has assembled a brigade of Nazi hunters.
Oh, but wow.
My God, it blew my mind. It is amazing.
I'd love to see that. Have you seen it? A Marathon Man?
No.
Oh my God.
Is it on Amazon? Similar,
it's a movie. It's a similar theme. It's a movie from the 70s about a Nazi death camp guard, I believe, or a Nazi killer who now is just a jeweler in Manhattan, and they're trying to track him down. And it's an incredible classic movie that I think this generation maybe hasn't seen it enough. It is unreal.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm checking it out today.
I really appreciate it if you do. In fact, if you could just watch it now and then we can continue. I'm just reminding him. Oh yeah, it's Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier and Roy Scheider.
Nice one. Okay, I'm checking it out.
All right.
And I'll let you know exactly what I think of it, because I'm in love with that era. And I think a lot more people, I think if every history teacher would spend an hour a month playing a movie that speaks to that era, it would eliminate a lot, right? And then it would educate a lot of people as well, because it's, like you said, it's one of the most well-documented parts of our history, and people must never forget.
People say you shouldn't, you know, some people are like, oh, don't show the movie, it doesn't tell the real story. But nothing tells the real story. Everything is biased in some way or through some filter. So a good movie is just as good as anything.
I look at our country. We went through apartheid for the longest time, and we're like 25 years out of it, but we don't have enough footage to show what the survivors keep telling people what happened, you know? And there's no interest to make movies that talk of that era, that painful past. And this was only 25 years ago.
There hasn't been a lot of feature films about that, have there?
Nope.
That's crazy.
Nope.
You know, I grew up among a lot of South Africans in Ohio. As it happens, my parents were friends with a lot of doctors, all of whom were from South Africa, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And end of story. It just sounds like I'm launching into some interesting something about it, and I don't have anything else to say about it.
And then you close your computer.
Yeah. Goodbye.
Zoom over. Dave, we have a segment on the podcast that we like, our guest has to tell us the craziest story that has ever happened to them. You know, a story, even if they told us it wasn't true, we probably wouldn't believe them, because it sounds so true and so obnoxious at the same time. Do you have something like that has ever happened to you in your life?
So I was one time when I was living in New York, I had a job where I worked in a hot dog, like it was a store that sold hot dogs. You know, you could a takeout counter, you could order hot dogs. And this guy came in and said, I don't have enough money for a hot dog, but I can trade you. I'll give you my penis if you give me a hot dog. And I was like, no, it's like $1.50 for a hot dog. And he's like, well, I don't have the money. And he took out a big, like, sort of garden shear. He cut off his penis, and then he sewed it up with a thread, a yarn, a twine, and he hands me his penis, which is still like alive and warm, and I give him the hot dog, and then he says, I only want the hot dog, and he gives me the bun back and says, just put the penis in the bun. And so he's like, I'll give you $10 if you eat my penis in that bun. And I was like, well, if you have $10, why didn't you just buy the hot dog in the first place? And he's like, all right, you got me there, but still, will you eat it? And I was like, I guess. And so I put like mustard and ketchup on it. And then I'm like about to bite it. And then I'm right before I eat the thing, I'm like, this is nuts. I don't want to do this. Like, what? Also, this is like just the whole situation is crazy. And he's like, you're right. You don't have to eat it. And so he was like, you know, have a good day. And I'm like, you know, you too. You have a good day too.
You made our night. This was one great episode. I enjoyed
it. Oh, is it night there?
Yes. It's 9 p.m.
What a mind fuck. Have a good night.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you so much, David. Bye.